Okay. Only 10 more presents to wrap. You're almost at the finish line. But first... There. The last one. Enjoy a Coca-Cola for a pause that refreshes.
This episode is brought to you by Salesforce, a global partner of Formula One. 600 Grand Prix. That's the landmark Aston Martin sporting director Andy Stevenson reached in Las Vegas. It's more than half the number of F1 races since the inception of the World Championship 75 years ago. What's extra special about Andy's achievement is that all 600 have been with the same team. So you won't be surprised to hear that he has loads of extraordinary stories from when F1 was very different.
He turned up to Manicor and he had to pass the fitness tests, which he did. And then he come back to me in the garage. He said, "Don't tell anybody, but I've got a broken leg." And I said, "What?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "I've had to have a bunch of painkillers to pass the medical, but I've got a broken leg." So we had to sort of make him comfortable in the car. And the race he won, he had a broken leg.
As well as that incredible story, Andy's seen a driver go to jail halfway through the season and another one disappearing during qualifying before then taking pole position. Here on F1 Beyond the Grid with me, Tom Clarkson, you're going to hear Andy's most astonishing experiences from the last 33 years in the paddock. Team Silverstone has known many different guises since starting out as Jordan Grand Prix back in 1991. It morphed into Midland, then Spyker, then Force India, then Racing Point, and it's now Aston Martin. Andy's been there throughout, having started as a mechanic on Eddie Jordan's Formula 3000 team prior to their graduation to Formula One. He talks about Eddie not liking him when he first joined, preparing Michael Schumacher for his unexpected debut, why he's remained loyal to the same team for so long, and why he thinks Aston Martin will become world champions. Andy's memories of the last three decades, and how the team and the sport has evolved during that time, are nothing short of sensational. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Andy, it's lovely to see you. How are things?
Things have been better. I mean, in Formula One, things are always good. To be involved in Formula One is fantastic. But at the moment, we have our challenges. The team's performance is not where we want it to be. And we've had quite a tough year. But there's a bright future ahead of us. Lots of things in the pipeline that will come to fruition very soon. We've got Adrian joining us. You know, who can't get excited about Adrian joining us? We can't wait for that to happen. We've got the new wind tunnel coming online. We've got our new simulator coming online. We're in the facility. We now call it our home. We're settled into it. It's an incredible place to work. We've hired lots and lots of new people to strengthen in all areas. We're ready to go. But yeah, at the moment, it's a little bit tough.
It's wonderful to hear you so excited about the future because you've been around for a while. And that's the sort of premise for coming to see you today. I mean, 600 races is an awful lot. So really my first question on that topic is, what is the secret to longevity in Formula One?
I've never really thought about it, but I think you've just got to love and enjoy what you're doing. I guess you've got to be good at it as well. I mean, I wouldn't pat myself on the back, but I would say one thing I do every day is challenge myself. I learned that from a very early age in motorsport. You've got to challenge yourself every single day to do a better job. Otherwise, the competitors are going to be better than you are. So each and every day when I get up, I'm thinking on the drive in, how can I improve on what I did yesterday? What issues have we got? What can we do better? It's you're always looking for a better way to do the job, a more competitive way, something that will bring you performance.
With your sporting director hat on, that also involves the regulations. I mean, do you know the sporting regs inside out?
I don't think I know them word for word, but I understand the sporting regulations. we're constantly evolving and changing them. So articles do move around a little bit, and the way that they're worded changes a little bit. I couldn't recite them to you, but if you were to ask me any rule, I could explain to you what the intention is and how best you use it to your advantage.
Yeah, you sound a formidable opponent to other teams and to the FIA, I suppose, in terms of even recently, there have been countless moments where that has come to the fore. I'm thinking Saudi Arabia last year, you got Fernando Alonso's third place reinstated because of your knowledge of the sporting regs, wasn't it?
Firstly, I'd like to say I think the FIA stewards do a fantastic job. They're in a really difficult situation. They're in a no-win situation. But the way that they go about their stewardship, I think, is very professional. It's very much underestimated how difficult it is in that room and for them to make the decisions that they make, because there's always someone who is going to feel hard done by. But the way I would put it, I'm not using my knowledge of the regulations to go against the FIA. It's to work with the FIA. And the situation that we had in Jeddah was very much, I felt that the stewards had made an incorrect decision. And I was very keen to understand how they'd come to that decision. And in having some, let's say, emotional conversations following the race with them, it was clear to me that the rules hadn't been applied as written and as agreed in the sporting advisory committee that I represent the team on. And it was just the case of me making that information available to the stewards, which allowed them then to reverse the decision again. And I want to say back in our favour. It wasn't. What they did was they did the right thing. And there's opportunities available to teams and the stewards to correct decisions when new information becomes available to them, to allow them to make the right decision. And we just use that to, I don't even want to say our advantage, we just use that to ensure that the final race classification was correct.
We'll come back to the present day a little bit later. I want to throw it back now to the 600, okay? The Sao Paulo Grand Prix was race number 1,122 of the World Championship, which means you've done more than half of the races in the history of the sport. Have the 600 flown by?
Absolutely. The first one in Phoenix, it could almost be last year.
Do you mean that?
Absolutely, yeah. I wouldn't say I could recall all 600 Grand Prix. They've all been different in their intensity, but that day in Phoenix, or that weekend in Phoenix, was so intense.
This is the grid for round one of the 1991 Formula One World Championship, the United States Grand Prix, on the street circuit in Phoenix, Arizona. On pole position, it's Ayrton Senna for the 53rd time in his career in the V12 Honda-powered McLaren. This is the Belgian driver, Bertrand Gachot, in the first ever Formula One race for a Jordan.
We were a very young team. It was our first year in Formula One. We weren't a young racing team, but we were a young Formula One team. And as much preparation as we'd put into turning up, we weren't ready at all. Most of us, probably 90% of the team, had never been to a Formula One race before to work. Yeah, we'd been to watch races at Silverstone, Brands Hatch and wherever, but we'd never actually worked at a Grand Prix. It was so exciting to turn up with the two Jordan cars, which we'd done quite a lot of testing and we'd been reasonably competitive in testing, but nobody took us seriously until we turned up there and...
turned up there for pre-qualifying.
For pre-qualifying, yeah. The Wide Awake Club. So I believe we used to run between 8 and 9 o'clock in the morning to pre-qualify to enter the event before the first practice session. Unfortunately, we only got one car through. Andreas, who would have easily gone through, hit a bump on the bumpy track around Phoenix. Bumps aren't new to Formula One. We've always had them. And he missed the gear and over-revved the engine. So unfortunately, that was him out of pre-qualifying. But Bertrand got through. And I can remember we hadn't done a practice pit stop until the Sunday morning. And we'd never done a live one until the race. And I remember the car coming in and we're all sort of looking at each other. What do we do now? It was not a particularly swift pit stop, let's say, but it was reliable. And Bertrand, I think, up to the closing stages of the race, had managed to get up to seventh position, which in those days, you were scoring points down to sixth. And we were on course to score a point, but unfortunately we had an engine failure and we didn't finish the race. But I do remember every session, the sunny morning when the two Jordan cars first went onto the track. Even to this day, it sends a little shiver down my spine because we were a small little team.
Well, from 18 people turned up in Phoenix. 18,
including drivers. I think at the time we probably had about 45 people working in the company in total. And this little team had turned up to take on the might of Formula One in Phoenix, Arizona. I mean, I'd never been to America before. It was really, really exciting times.
Can we wind the clock back a little bit in terms of when did you actually join Eddie Jordan's team? So the team goes into Formula One in 1991, but you'd already been there for a few years, am I right?
Yeah, so I joined the team back end of 1987. They just won the British Formula 3 Championship with Johnny Herbert, and I joined in the winter in preparation for the 1988 championship.
Joined as a what?
As a mechanic. So I'd been working for another Formula 3 team, a little family-run team called Magnum Race Cars. I'd been working them for a year, and I'd had the pleasure to meet a chap called Bosco Quinn, who had originally worked for Eddie Jordan, and he'd gone to work for Magnum because he wanted to be a team manager. He was running the team at Magnum. And then he came back to run Eddie's Formula 3 team. And Bosco gave me a call and said, why don't you come in for an interview? For me, that was super exciting. Young kid working in motorsport and you've got the current Formula 3 champions calling you. This was my big break. My ambition had always been to work in motorsport. And this was the big break, champions. So my mum brings me over in for the interview. It was on a Tuesday evening at Silverstone. And we come to old Unit 19. And I'm sitting having an interview with Bosco, who I knew pretty well, and basically he was telling me the job's mine. And Eddie bursts into the interview. Bosco, who's this guy? He used rather more colourful language. And Bosco said, oh, this is Andy. I'm hiring him for next season to join us on the F3 team. Don't like the look of him, don't hire him. So thinking, oh, that interview went well. So Bosco said, don't worry about him. You got the job. Yeah, come and start on whatever the start date was. By that day, I got myself a car. Didn't think I could get my mum to bring me to work. Got to work nice and early. The factory office was still locked up, so I just sat outside in my car. And to Eddie's credit, and he always did it all the way through the time that he owned the company, he was one of the first there. So Eddie arrives, unlocking the office door, and I walk up to the office door. He turns around. What do you want? I said, oh, I'm starting work for you today. My name's Andy Stevenson. Pleased to meet you. I told you I don't like you. I don't want you to work for me. Go home. So you think, oh, great. I've just left my other job.
What happened next?
I had to sit in my car. So I sat in my car until Bosco arrived, and Bosco said, ignore him. And he put me on a few projects. And then Eddie turns up in the workshop. What are you doing here? I said, well, you have to speak to Bosco. He said, I own the company. I was really enjoying the job. You know, I'm working for the current Formula 3 champions, and I'm working away on a race car doing some modifications to some electronic control units that control the engines. And basically, I'm making some ECUs work on an engine that they shouldn't do, using one engine manufacturer, and I was making the boxes work for another engine manufacturer, just trying to save some money. Eddie comes in, what are you doing? And I say, look, I'm converting these boxes for you. Oh, he says, so you're pretty talented then. I said, well, you know, I can hold my own. He said, it's 10 o'clock at night. He said, you all start like that. Guaranteed in 3 weeks' time, you'll be gone. To which I'm thinking, right, I'll show Eddie. I'll show him how good I am.
Or how good I can be. Wanted to prove him wrong.
And I'm thinking, you know, I'm all over this. It took me about 20 years to realize all Eddie was doing was motivating me to get the most out of me possible. It was his way of, I'll make sure this guy works.
And was he like that with most people?
Yeah. he was fantastic to work for. He was a great manager, really good. You know, people see Eddie Jordan racing and Jordan Grand Prix from the outside and would look and probably say, you know, is this team taking things seriously? Is it run properly? We were an incredibly serious team, very, very competitive, super competitive, often underfunded, but very, very competitive. And Eddie was a racer through and through. He was, and still is, one of the most competitive people that you will ever meet. And he run it very well. He really did. He could, probably some of them would be considered old techniques now, but he would really get the most out of everybody. And if you weren't an out-and-out racer and you weren't competitive, you didn't last long there. So he was always challenging people. How much do you want this job? How much do you want to be here? How much do you want to win?
And you did win. I mean, yeah. 1989, you win the F3000 championship with Jean Alesi.
Fantastic year.
How quick was Jean back then?
So Jean was very underestimated. We had Martin in the sister car.
That's Martin Donnelly.
Martin Donnelly, yeah. And the whole idea was that it was going to be Martin's year. Eddie had got the Camel money in, which was big budget money in those days for a Formula 3000 team. And it was, right, we're going to put everything behind Martin. But he needs a good teammate. And Jean Alesi had become available, who also bought a big budget with him. He was a very well-funded driver, but incredibly underestimated. And a lot of people questioned why Eddie did it. They thought he'd done it for the money. But Eddie always had an eye for talent in race drivers, and he spotted something. And we went to Vallelunga in one of the old cars in 1998, Formula 3000 Reynard. And Jean broke the lap record. He got in the car. He drove so, so well in testing, so fast, found it so easy. And we found that we'd just put, you know, he was quite an emotional guy. But he was in an environment where he was happy and he trusted everybody he was working with. So suddenly we had two drivers that could win the world champion, the international championship, as it was known then. So it was a great year. I think the first race was Silverstone. Jean finished on the podium. We had a drive shaft failure. And then we finished first and third in the Birmingham Super Prix after Martin's car. He spun, got caught up in an accident, wrote the chassis off. We had to build a new car overnight. First and third there. We finished first and second in Brands Hatch.
Andy, this is phenomenal. Your memory of these races is what's really striking me now. And of course, so you go on and win that championship. But yeah. At what point do you think Eddie's ambitions swap to Formula One?
From what I recall, it was through the 89 season. That was when Eddie started to talk quite serious of taking the team to Formula One. I mean, we're heads down, we're focusing on what we're doing, and we're thinking, yeah, that's a nice dream, and hopefully we'll be involved. But then he really started to put things in place in early 1990 with Andrew Green joining us, Gary Anderson joining us. And the crazy thing was that first year, that first, the 911 as we knew it, when it was being designed, was you had Andrew and Gary were designing the car, but they were also the engineers for the two race cars in Formula 3000. I mean, it was bonkers. So we're trying to design a Formula One car. We had Andrew, Gary, and Mark Smith. Three guys did predominantly all the work. We've got 900 people here now. And we made a pretty good car. So it was, 1990 was when things started to happen. And towards the middle of 1990, Eddie sat a few of us down and said, right, we're going to do Formula One. Who's in? So it wasn't even an interview. And not everybody was keen on doing it. Not everybody wanted to do Formula One. And also there was a big risk. And Eddie made it very clear to us. It was a huge risk he was taking. This could have been all or nothing. So if you were going to go with him, there was a fair chance at the end of the season, the first season, you might not have a job. But we decided to take the risk and never look back.
Talk us through the moment that John Watson drives the car for the first time. The 191, as it went on to be known, not the 911.
Here at Silverstone, I can't remember what month it was, but it was damp. And it was much like a day like today. It was damp and a bit foggy. We all turned up with our Formula 3000 truck, still in Formula 3000 colours. We had our Formula 3000 kit on with little badges, same Formula 1. And Watty, who was a good friend of the team, always had been, had volunteered to drive the car for the first time because basically we didn't have anybody else to do it either. But it was having John Watson in the car was fantastic for us to actually, you know, have a proper Formula One driver do the shakedown and let us know whether we'd got our sums right. It wasn't long before John came back and said, you've built a proper Formula One car. We'd been building the car for what seemed like forever because we spent a whole year sort of building that car, the chassis arriving, gearbox, building up the gearboxes. But we'd been doing that over many, many months. So to get the car actually on the track, I remember there was big discussions on whether we were actually going to paint it or not for the shakedown and the launch. And the decision was not to paint it because we couldn't afford to. But the car looked pretty good.
Beautiful looking car.
In black, yeah. It looked fantastic in just lacquered carbon. But John, yeah, he drove it and he come back and we realised pretty quickly that it looked like that we had a car that we could go and compete with. We just had to go and find a couple of drivers.
Can you remember how the rest of the Formula One paddock treated you? What was their attitude towards Jordan at that time?
We first met the Formula One paddock when we started going testing. I think it was Paul Ricard, I remember. We're there and all the big guns are there. You had Ferrari were there, McLaren were there. And we were actually welcomed. We felt welcome. It wasn't like people were saying, you guys don't deserve to be here. It was like, oh, this is kind of exciting. Who's this little team that's just turned up? And when we couldn't find the right nuts and bolts to put the car together, people were helping us out. But it wasn't long before that help stopped. Once they started to realize that we were serious and we could probably challenge some of them and make their life a little bit difficult, life in the paddock started to become a little bit difficult. Not bad, you know, just teams being competitive. Let's not make it too easy for them.
Well, and then the epitome of that must have come in Canada 91 when you scored not only your first points, but both cars in the points.
Both cars in the points, yeah. We were, we were desperate to score points because we wanted to get out of pre-qualifying. That was a lot of our motivation. We didn't want to get up at 4 o'clock every Friday morning to go and qualify the cars. So the big bonus of scoring points at that point was you would be out of pre-qualifying. And we had a good car. The guys were racing well and we were sitting fifth and sixth. And we're thinking, this is great. Just finish the race. And the leader was on the last lap and we're still fifth and sixth. And we're thinking, this is fantastic. Brilliant. Fifth and sixth. And the leader broke down, which we all know it was Nigel. Still debatable whether he switched the car off, turning, waving at the crowd. We'll never know.
Oh, no, Patrick Head knows. He's told me.
So we went from fifth and sixth to fourth and fifth. And in those days in Formula One, that was a bunch of points. And we were out of pre-qualifying and a huge celebration.
But that was the overriding emotion then. We're out of pre-qualifying. That was the main thing.
That was the one for us. For Eddie, it would have been we're in the prize money. That would have been the important thing for him. But to be honest with you, in those days, he kept all of that away from us. He looked after the finances and he made sure we got paid every week and our job was just to deliver on track. So we weren't aware of how tight things would have been. But for Eddie, it would have been a huge relief because it would have meant that, yeah, he was then going to be part of the prize money for the following year.
Do you think success came too soon for the team? Two cars in the points back then was a huge result. As you say, only the top six scored. Formula One is a really hard business. Do you think it came too soon?
No, I think we deserved it. We put a lot of hard work into it. And like I said, we turned up. We didn't know Formula One, but we were very professional. And we had a great car. We deserved it. Absolutely. Moving on to 92, yeah, things became difficult. Again, I think the 92 car was a reasonable car. We just suffered a lot with reliability, whether it be gearbox or engine. We were trying to be innovative. We knew we couldn't do a semi-automatic gearbox, so we tried to introduce the first sequential shift gearbox into Formula One, and it was a difficult year. I think each and every point we got in 91, we absolutely deserved.
Let's talk about mid-summer 91 now, where one of your drivers, Bertrand Gachot, has an altercation with a London taxi driver. Can you remember how that news broke? And talk us through the build-up to that Belgian Grand Prix.
I was working with Bertrand on his car, and I'd known Bertrand for quite a few years, so we were pretty good friends anyway. And he'd made us aware that he was dealing with an issue, let's say. But he did say that the consequences could end up being reasonably serious, but he never indicated to us that he would be going to jail. You know, he was just said, I'm dealing with a spot of bother. We went to Hungary. This was where he told us in Hungary. He said, you know, things might be getting difficult for me in the next few weeks. Bertrand had always been suffering with huge understeer in the car, always complaining to Gary about understeer. And then just before qualifying, he says, I've got to grips with the understeer. I know what to do now. I know what to do. So he says, the car's really, really working for me. And in the race, he broke the lap record, which, you know, in our car, Jordan Grand Prix, new to Formula One, to set a lap record in a race, in a Grand Prix, was phenomenal. So we were all riding high. We were thinking, you know, we're having a good year. Things are going very, very well for us. And then we get back, we're preparing for Belgium, and the news comes through, Bertrand's gone to jail. And then the story comes out, and, you know, everybody was made aware of what happened, and we were just absolutely gutted, like mortified. Bertrand was part of the team. Without Bertrand, we wouldn't have been on the grid that year. He again helped with the funding. He brought some really important sponsors along, and he was fast, very fast. So we had the experience and the speed of Andrea De Cesaris, who I always believe was very underestimated in how quick he was, and he was fast. I witnessed it. And then we had Bertrand, who was a young guy learning from Andreas, doing a really good job. So we were mortified.
How serious did it get in terms of jobs? Did you worry that this would be the end of the team, or was Eddie very reassuring in that respect?
No, Eddie was reassuring, and he had a plan. He had a plan, and we always trusted him. We'd been with him a few years by then, and you know, Eddie did some quite unique things along the line. I've been to races with Eddie where we've had sponsorship, Marlboro on one car and Camel on the other. I've been to races where we've had Marlboro on one side of the car and Camel on the other. And how he's kept it away from sponsors, I have no idea. But he was very good at doing stuff, a very shrewd businessman as well as a good manager. So we had confidence that Eddie would sort it out.
And when did it become apparent to you that a guy called Michael Schumacher was going to be doing the race?
Eddie came into the workshop and said to a few of us, I need you to stay late tonight. You can't talk about what you're doing, but we've got a driver coming along and we need you to do a seat fit. So we're, who is it? You know, Alan Prost or Nigel Mansell? Who's coming? And someone knocked at the door, and we went and opened the door, and there was this young chap there, and he was like, oh, I've come here to see Eddie Jordan. And we're like, no, he's gone home, mate. You have to come back tomorrow. No, I'm here tonight for a seat fit. It's like, who is this guy? And it was Michael Schumacher. So there was myself and chap Nick Burrows, who worked here for many, many years. We stayed late to make the seat with Michael. Eddie appeared sort of later, oh, this is Michael. Who's Michael? But yeah, we knew nothing about him, nothing at all. We'd heard he'd done a bit of sports car racing, and he'd done some racing out in Japan, but we didn't really know him.
What were your first impressions?
First impressions was, I'm fitting this guy into the car who's so young. and he was same age as myself. So my first impression was, I'm jealous. This guy's going to get to drive the race car. But he was fantastic to work with. You know, this was he was obviously looking forward to his opportunity in a Formula One car. We made the seat. He got very, very involved. And he said, look, guys, I turned up a little bit late. So if you want to go home, I'll finish the seat off. He said, I can tape it, you know, as we used to in the old days, tape them up. So I said, all right, I'll take you up on that one. And went home and he finished his seat.
Really? Yeah. Michael Schumacher finished his first seat.
Yeah, it was his first Formula One seat, so he was as pleased as anybody. And then we were running the car. And we said, well, this is who's going to be racing for us in Spa. Oh, okay. He seems like a nice guy. Let's see how he does. So we, the only opportunity we had for him to run in a Formula One car was to run at what we used to know as the old Silverstone South Circuit. And by this time, everything had left. So all the big trucks had left to go off to Spa. And we kept the one race car behind. And we took it over to the circuit with a transit and trailer. And the toolboxes and starter motors were piled into the back of my car. And off we went to run probably one of the most successful Formula One drivers of all time at Silverstone South Circuit. And we got him in the car. We eventually got the thing going. And he's driving round and round. And he's starting to get closer and closer to our lap record around the South Circuit within a handful of laps. And then he went faster than we've ever gone around the Silverstone South Circuit. So Trevor Foster, the then team manager and race engineer for Michael, come on the radio and said, listen, Michael, we'd like you just to back off a little bit because these cars can get away from you. You know, they're very fast cars. And Michael just come over the radio and said, I haven't even started yet. Then, off we went to Spa.
Can we start at the beginning of that Spa weekend? Because all the drivers turn up wearing T-shirts saying, you know, free Gasho. And yeah, there was all this right from Alain Prost down.
Bertrand, I think it was.
Bertrand. So where were your loyalties at that particular moment? Were you still thinking we must get Bertrand back in the car? Or actually, had you seen enough at the Silverstone South Circuit to think, hang on, this Schumacher guy might be the future?
What I recall at that point was we're doing our job. So we're running Michael that weekend. There was the hope that Bertrand would manage to overturn his conviction and we'd see him very soon. But for that weekend, the focus was on, we've got this new kid in the car. We've got to make him feel at home. We've got to get him settled in and we've got to race. You know, that's what we're there for. Like I say, I was and still am good friends with Bertrand. And I was really upset at the time, but we had a job to focus on. And I think that's what you do when you're in motorsport, when you're in Formula One. You've got to focus on the weekend ahead of you. All the other noise, you've got to sort of put it to one side at that time. So it was fully focused on getting the most out of the car and Michael.
And Michael is 11th fastest in the first practice session, right? First time he'd driven at Spa.
First time he'd been round Spa. He told us he'd raced there. He'd never been there before in his life.
Was he doing things in that car that De Cesaris just couldn't do? I mean, when you look at the data or...
Well, there wasn't a great deal of data to look at. I think we had 3 sensors on the car back then. So it was all about driver feedback and lap time. Yeah, you could see on the throttle traces where he's on and off the throttle. But he was just always in control, but very brave. What we were seeing, it looked like he was going beyond, but to him, he was just inside. So always right on the limit. But in complete control, very calm and very confident.
And good feedback?
Very good feedback. Not like the feedback we get now. I mean, the feedback we get now is phenomenal. But for the day, yeah, very, very good feedback. And the other thing that he turned up with, which at the time probably wasn't as popular, he was extremely fit.
Was obvious to you even then.
Yeah, and the cars in those days were beasts. There was no power steering. They had massive tyres, huge wings. So the G-forces were big. The effort to turn the wheel was huge. That just didn't faze him. He was extremely fit.
And then when you lose him after one race and he goes to Benetton, what was the mood in the team?
That was, you know, we'd lost 2 drivers in 2 events. You know, for different reasons. And that then was, you're starting to think, is this how it's always going to be? And certainly in Monza, it felt like we were part of a team that didn't quite fit. You know, we discovered this talent. Eddie had discovered this talent. We're thinking, right, you know, we're really going to make something of this guy now. It almost felt like, no, someone from above has decided this is the wrong place for this guy. We've got to put him somewhere else. And it felt like everything was against us then. And of course, we had Roberto turn up and we had to make him feel at home and get him in the car.
Andy, isn't that the thing about what I call Team Silverstone? In that Have you always felt, apart from now, let's forget the Aston Martin era, but if you think of the Jordan Grand Prix times, the Midland, the Spyker, the Force India times, did you feel that the world was against you throughout that period?
I think you're correct, yeah. I never really thought about it, but we did. Yeah, we often felt like we shouldn't be there, which meant we had to fight even harder to deserve our spot and to show people what we were capable of.
And so, yeah, we can talk about, you know, victories, and we can talk about Fernando's podiums last year, but actually those two fourth places in the Constructors' Championship in 16 and 17, were they actually the high points for you? Because you proved the establishment with a capital E, yeah, you proved them wrong.
They had to accept. It was, I think, thinking about it, it was always, everybody always talked about the big four in Formula One. It's always the big four, the big four, the big four. When we were in the big four, they spoke about the big three.
And do you know what? I can sort of remember that. Yeah.
And it was, people still don't want to accept. But that doesn't upset me. That motivates me. And I think it motivates everybody here. We do deserve to be in Formula One. And we're going to prove to you
why. But that desire to prove people wrong, I mean, for me, it oozes out of you. It goes right back to what Eddie Jordan said to you on day one, wanting to prove him wrong. The team wants to prove the establishment wrong. And even now, with the resources you have, is there an undercurrent within Aston Martin of wanting to prove the Formula One establishment wrong?
My answer to that will be, we will prove them wrong. So, yeah, not we want to, we will.
Can we take it back to Spa? Because a lot seems to have happened for the team at Spa. Obviously, you know, there was the Schumacher debut, which we've talked about. Then the first pole position comes with Rubens Barrichello,
yeah,
in the wet in 1994. The first win at Spa in 1998 comes with Damon Hill as well. Have you always felt a bit of an affinity to that place?
Yeah.
Because of the champagne?
I've joked to a few people that we know a shortcut around that track because we've had great success there. But so my first ever race working for a team was at Spa with Magnum race cars, and they got their best result they ever had at that race. Then I went there in 1988 with Jason Elliott. Jason had had a tough season, puts it on the front row. Unfortunately, he didn't finish the race. We had a bit of an incident, but that was our first front row start. We go there with John Alesi and Martin Donnelly in 89. Non-championship round, pouring with rain. Jean says, too dangerous, I'm not racing. He decided to race, we won the race. Spa 91 with Michael, great qualifying, then had a problem. And then Andreas challenging for the lead. Again, we had an engine failure, so we didn't get the result. But it's one of the tracks we like. We always look forward to going there.
Get ready, it's Britain and Ireland all around the world to stand up and cheer as Damon Hill wins in Belgium. Fantastic! Eddie Jordan at last, after all his efforts, after fighting his way up, sees victory and is now very much one of the top five. A proud, proud and very happy day for Jordan, for Damon Hill, for Ralf Schumacher and for the whole team.
I feel we must talk about the first win. Damon Hill's first, Ralf Schumacher in the sister car is second. Those images of Eddie on the podium. And I think, am I right that the whole factory had been bused to the race?
Yeah,
sort of.
So we decided it had been a really, really tough season. And to motivate all the staff, all those who wanted to go were offered a chance to go to the race. So we had, I think it was three or four coaches head out from Silverstone and they were there for race day. So at the end of the race at the podium, we had basically the whole factory there. It was amazing feeling. Really, really cool.
Yeah, hugely emotional. Is that one of the most emotional moments of your 600 here?
It's one of the moments that always sort of sticks out. It was a favourite time for a long time. But I always try and look forwards and not back. But it was, It was great. Yeah, we'd never won a Grand Prix before, so it was great. To do it with one and two as well was fantastic. I mean, a lot of things had to go our way during the race. But, you know, in the end, the drivers did a great job, and they managed to bring it home after a bit of negotiation with the management. There was a time that we thought we could lose it all. If it was going to get a bit punchy between the two drivers on track.
Because you were on Ralf Schumacher's car then.
I was on Ralf's car, yeah. And when the rain got heavier, he really found some pace and caught up with Damon very, very quickly, which was when Damon was on the radio. And there's a reason Damon is a world champion, because you've got to think of everything. All he had on his mind was, I want to win this race, and I've now got to persuade the owner that this is how we're going to finish this race to get the most points for the team.
And how did you feel when you heard that radio message?
To be honest, I was absolutely fine, because for me, it's always been about the team. I'm part of a team, so it's not my personal results, it's the team results. So I had absolutely no issue at all. I can't say the same for Ralf. He was really, really upset, but...
Yeah, and then I think Michael got involved afterwards.
Michael, yeah,
as well.
It was a bit of a mess. And
I've heard people say that was the catalyst point for Ralf going to Williams the following year.
But it was a turning point. But for me, I couldn't have been happier. I was ecstatic.
Well, can we talk about a time when you might have been happier still? 99 was thus far, it's the team's best finish in the World Championship. You finished third. You have Heinz Harald Frentzen join the team. Can we start by talking about Heinz? He's been on the podcast, and he came across as incredibly technical, incredibly analytical, but how quick was he?
We'd had the pleasure of working with Heinz beforehand anyway, because in 1990, we ran him in the Formula 3000 Championship with alongside Manuel Inaspetti and Eddie Irvine. So we'd already seen how fast he was. We'd had Ralf in the team, obviously, and we were really sad to see him go. So we're looking for another driver. And at that time, the Formula One had fallen out of love with Heinz. He had his time at Sauber, and he'd gone to Williams and had quite a tough time. But we knew how quick he could be. We'd worked with him before. So Eddie decided to sign him up. And he came over to the factory, and I remember walking around the factory with Heinz and Sam Michael, and we're in the 7-post rig room, which we just commissioned. And you could see then that Heinz was really into all the detail. He wanted to understand how every single part of the car worked so that he could utilize it to his best advantage. Sometimes he was a little bit too analytical. I mean, he loved it. He always said he wanted to be an engineer, but he was better at driving. His dream job is an aerodynamicist, but he said he wasn't good enough for it. He was so fast, and over one lap, almost untouchable. And he'd shown us that in Formula 3000 as well. So, so fast, so committed, so brave. His problem was in the race that his mind could sometimes wander because of his curiosities. And he would do random things like push buttons in the car just to see what it would do, which we're always having to tell him off for. It was.
Andy, are you serious about that? Because I'm now thinking of, was it Nürburgring? Mm-hmm. He's exiting the pits and just grinds to a halt. Is that because he hadn't he pressed the wrong button? Yeah,
that wasn't one of his experiments, but he'd done some other stuff. So Nürburgring was really, really interesting. We were still fighting for the world championship, drivers'
if
world championship.
If he'd won that race, Andy, that he would have come out right behind Coulthard, I think, who was leading at the time.
Yeah. So the race was quite interesting. The qualifying was quite interesting. So he was happy with the car. He knew he had a fast car. In qualifying, back then, you just had the hour, and you went out and set your fastest lap, and everybody involved. You had qualifying engines and everything, so it was quite an exciting time. The weather was a bit shaky, and it was a damp track. The team manager had said to Sam, right, let's get Heinz in the car and let's get him out, put a banker lap in. And Heinz is sitting in the car. Nah, not going out. No, we want you to go out, put a banker lap in. No, not doing it. Yeah, but yellow flags, red flags, let's get a banker lap in. Heinz just then gets out of the car, disappears. So we're in the garage. Qualifying's running. Everyone's going round, setting lap times. We've done nothing. We're sitting in the garage. And we go and find his manager. Said, look, you've got to get him back. We're qualifying. We've got to put him in the car. His manager comes back. I can't find him. I'm thinking, well, this is a disaster. We've got a great car, no driver. He comes back with 10 minutes to go. Doesn't talk to anybody. Gets in the car, looks at me. Are we ready? Said, yeah, let's go. Goes out, puts it on pole.
What? And I've never heard that story before.
It was the most bizarre thing ever. But when Hines is around, a lot of bizarre things happen. He's a very, very special character. Very unique. You don't meet many like him.
And when he was on it?
When he was on it.
Properly on it, wasn't he? I mean, people say that of the triumvirate in the Mercedes Junior program, Wendlinger, Schumacher and Frentzen, over one lap, he was the quickest.
He could beat anyone. Yeah. I mean, he did some great stuff that year. Not many people know this, and I can probably say it now, but in Manicourt, we'd been in Canada the week before, 2 weeks before, and he'd had a big accident. He had rear brake failure, big accident, and actually knocked himself about quite a bit. And he turned up to Manicourt, and he had to pass the fitness tests, which he did. And then he come back to me in the garage. He said, don't tell anybody, but I've got a broken leg. And I said, what? He said, yeah, yeah. He said, I've had to have a bunch of painkillers to pass the medical, but I've got a broken leg. So we had to sort of make him comfortable in the car. And the race he won, he had a broken leg.
Oh, my God. So,
I mean, it wasn't like in two pieces, yeah, sort of hanging off. But, yeah, he was in a lot of pain. And that would have been his breaking leg as well. So we had to adapt the cockpit so that he could keep his leg as straight as possible, so that he could get the braking forces through, because he had very little strength to drive the car how he would normally. And you might think, he's telling a bit of a story or whatever, but after the race, he turned around to Sam and I and he said, let's go party.
Manicourt.
Well, exactly. So we jumped in his little private jet and we flew off to Monaco. We're in the nightclub and all night he had to dance off with one leg. The other leg was in the air. He couldn't put any weight on it at all.
Andy, that is the most extraordinary story and says an awful lot about Frentzen, actually,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Okay, there was the race win in the offing, of course, but he must have truly believed at that point that he could win the world championship.
Yeah, we'd spoken about it. He used to spend a lot of time at the factory and he made it very apparent to us that he wanted to win the world championship.
And do you think the team believed that it could win the world championship?
No, not at the beginning. And then as time progressed, we realized how serious this attempt could be. And you go back to the ifs and buts and maybes, but you can't help but do it. In Imola, he was running in fourth position. Eddie Irvine was in the Ferrari in third, had an engine failure. That promoted Hines to third, but he spun off on the oil that Irvine left behind. In Canada, he was running third, had a brake failure. In Nürburgring, he was leading the race by about 10 seconds. The story behind that one was we had a device in the car because we were starting to get punchy because we were thinking, right, there is a championship at stake here now. And we had a launch device from the pit stops. And in those days, launch devices were banned. But as long as the driver was in control, you could get clearance from the FIA and they were happy with your systems, you could run them. And our system was, yes, we had this launch control, but the driver was in control because he has to reset a button or the engine turns off. So he's in full control. So we come in for the pit stop, he launches, and we have a procedure where someone in the garage, the control tech, shouts over the radio to the race engineer, reset, reset, reset. Race engineer then, reset, reset, reset. Hines resets, off we go. And unfortunately, there'd been a bit of a mix-up. Reset, 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 on the wrong channel. So the message never got through to Hines. He should have known anyway. But it never got through to him, so he didn't reset. And that means after 5 seconds, engine turns off, and you can't turn it back on. And it was some technology that we'd agreed with the FIA. They'd signed it off, and it was to give us a little bit of an advantage in the pit stops. You know, we're talking 1 or 2 tenths of a second. But that was where we were at then. You know, that we were fighting for a world championship, and we were trying every single trick in the book to get there.
Again, another extraordinary story from that 99 season. And then there's that photograph of him just stationary at turn one at the Nürburgring, and
gut-wrenching.
The picture I've got in my mind is his head's slightly tilted forward in the cockpit.
We all knew. We all knew what had happened.
Did he know immediately?
Yeah.
As well?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so you've got the guy in the garage kicking himself because his radio was on the wrong channel. You've got Sam knowing, I should have said it and didn't say it. And you've got Heinz, I know I've got a reset, and he didn't do it. That really then broke our sort of chances of the championship. We by then, we'd made too many mistakes.
But the mood in the team, did you feel for 2000 that you could carry the momentum on and that you had a chance following season?
I mean, yeah, it's always difficult because every year, you know, you're building a car and you're hoping it's going to be quicker than the one you had the year before. But we knew that 99 car was so good. So we didn't know initially, though. So you could say very much a missed opportunity. Back then we were saying, you know, well, where would we have been if we'd won the world championship? Which we didn't, so it doesn't really matter. I mean, 99 was a really tough year for me as well. And I just, maybe I'm patting myself on the back here, but unbeknown to me at the time, I'd been really, really poorly for a long time. And I got diagnosed with Crohn's disease. And the reason I want to say that is because Crohn's disease is quite a tough thing to live with. But I also like to tell everybody, because I say it shouldn't stop you doing anything you want to do. But in 99, we were under a lot of pressure, and I ended up losing sort of nearly 15 kilos in weight, and I was a lot thinner than I was now back then. So to lose 15 kilos, I was looking proper poorly.
For people who don't know, how does Crohn's affect you day to day?
Crohn's disease is basically, it's an autoimmune system deficiency, which it attacks people in different ways, but for me, it attacked my digestive system. And it basically meant I couldn't digest food. Anything you were to eat, you basically couldn't digest, and it's extremely painful. So the way you deal with it before it's diagnosed is you just don't eat because it's too painful. And that weekend in Nürburgring was when the disease had really, really got hold of me. So I was in quite a bad way, to the extent I missed the next round in Malaysia, which was the first race I'd missed. It's one of the few that I've missed since 91. At the time, I thought I was probably not going to go racing again.
How do you manage it on a day-to-day basis now with all the countries you visit, all the different diets you're eating around the world?
Yeah, so I've been very fortunate with the medical team and the doctor or the consultant that I was put under, and we found a way of controlling it. I struggled for a long time. We've had to use some pretty hard-hitting drugs to get it under control, which worked, which was good news. But now it's all, you've just got to look after yourself. Crohn's isn't always that easy, but I find I can manage it through lifestyle.
I mean, hang on, Andy, we've just come back from a triple header where we effectively had a one-day Grand Prix weekend. It felt like that on Sunday in Brazil. That doesn't strike me as a lifestyle where you're looking after yourself.
I guess you have to, you adapt. Once I found out that we were doing a 7:30 qualifying, we left the track. I was in bed at 8 o'clock. You've got to give your body time to recover. You've got to sleep. So you have to be quite disciplined with yourself. Saying that, I still go and enjoy myself. And you learn to find the foods that your body is happy to digest that don't stress your body inside. One of the things that's really helped me, and I know I've beaten you around the track a few times, is running. Crohn's for me was quite often wrought on when the body was stressed. So not your mind being stressed, but when your body was stressed. And I think just staying fit and running and de-stressing the body, I find running is so, so important.
And was it a huge relief for you when you actually were diagnosed mid-99?
Yeah. Yeah, because I don't want to go into what all the symptoms are, but you think things are a lot worse than they are. It is incredibly painful. You lose all the weight. Nobody can tell you why. And it was in Nürburgring where I was out the back of the garage after the race, a bit upset. And Eddie was like, geez, he said, what's happened to you? I said, Eddie, I don't know. I've just felt ill for months. And he said, okay. The next day, I was down in Harley Street. He'd sorted out the best gastroenterologist he could find. And I've been seeing that doctor ever since.
The man who didn't want you to work for him. Yeah,
he only sent me to the doctor because he was thinking, geez, this guy's not going to be out. I'm not going to get my money's worth out of him.
I'm not going to get my 14 hours a day out of this guy.
Let's get him fixed and back.
So that 99 season was the peak of the mountain in terms of achievements. And then did it feel it just slipped away after that?
I missed the Malaysian Grand Prix, the first year that we raced Formula One there. And it took Hines a bit of time to find his way around. I think he ended up finishing sixth, but we'd lost a bunch of points by then. And I think the momentum then had gone. Because we still were a relatively small team compared to the others, we probably ran out of developments. So the others kept going and we just couldn't keep up.
And then 2000, 2001, 2003, of course, Fisi wins the, Giancarlo Fisichella wins the Brazilian Grand Prix in 2003. But by then, was the writing on the wall for the team, at least under Eddie Jordan's ownership?
We were struggling. It was at the time the big manufacturers were coming in. And you know, Eddie was trying his best to attract a manufacturer to the team, but manufacturers wanted to have full control. Eddie was very much, this is my team. So you're not going to have full control. So we were competing, you know, we had Honda had come in big, Mercedes were coming in big. You had, BMW. It was a very difficult period of time for the privateer and we hung on for as long as we could, but it just become too difficult. And I don't know, I mean, you'd have to ask Eddie yourself, but I think the mistake he made was he wanted to be in absolute control of everything. There was probably a deal to be had where he'd still be team principal, but he's got to answer to a board, but he didn't want to do that. And again, I think because we all know Eddie and he's extremely proud, but extremely competitive. And it's like, no, I'm not going to go and do that for someone else. I'm doing it for me.
And how did he break the news then in that winter of 2004, 2005 that he was selling the team?
So he was coming up with a plan to save the team. He knew he couldn't take it on any further. It was going to put the team under huge risk for the following season. So he was running around trying to pull a deal together. He pulled a deal together. From what I remember, the deal was done pretty quickly. And the guys coming in, once it was signed, basically said to Eddie, right, we want you out of the building now. And I think he was given a few moments to gather his thoughts. We gathered the team in the race bays where we always did. Eddie stood up, told us that our future was secure, that he'd done everything he possibly could to make sure everybody's jobs were secure, and that he was no longer the boss or the owner. And turned around. He was clearly distressed. You saw the human side of Eddie. You saw the fragile side. And he'd put everybody else first. I mean, he probably could have got a much better deal if he'd waited, but it was, he knew everybody's jobs were on the line and he wanted to get something secured for everybody's future. And he succeeded in that. We had some tough times afterwards, but we all had jobs.
I mean, the person who buys the team, Alex Schneider, Russian billionaire, then the team bounces from him to Spyker. And then Vijay Mallya comes in 2008. Was that the first time since Eddie had sold that you felt stability within the team? Or am I doing a disservice to Midland and Spyker?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I didn't have much to do with Alex Schneider, but what I did have to do with him, he was a really, really cool guy. And a great businessman. I mean, he turned a profit on our team very quickly. He is part of the future. He kept the team going. He invested enough money in the team, not to develop as we needed to, but to survive. But I guess that was his investment. He had to. And then we went through the days with Spyker, which were very tough. Great looking car, though. I love the color scheme. I thought it was a really cool color scheme. But then, yeah, Vijay turned up and he had a plan, or as he used to say, I have a vision. And Vijay, motorsport mad, he knew the business very well. And he was running successful businesses around the world. But unfortunately for Vijay, we had the credit crunch come just when he was trying to invest in everything. He's trying to start an airline when fuel prices went through the roof, where it was very difficult to start an airline. So times were difficult for him. But I think I was with him longer than I was with Eddie. And it was fantastic working with Vijay. What a person. So interesting.
And so passionate about Formula One.
Extremely passionate. And when Vijay spoke, you listened, because he had incredibly interesting things to say. And he was always very thoughtful before he actually said anything. And when he spoke, it was worth listening to and worth acting on. Absolutely.
I remember when he came in, there being an incredible amount of hope for this team that actually this was going to launch you back into the big time. At least that was the view from the outside. Was that the feeling inside as well?
Yeah, very, very much so. And that was certainly Vijay's plan. But like I say, I think his plans got scuppered. His money didn't dry up, but he didn't have the funds available to him that when he initially bought the team that he thought he'd have available to him. So the first few months, there was a lot of changes going on. You know, there was a lot of investment, a lot of things improving overnight. And you were thinking, wow, this is the big time. We're really going to make a difference here now. But things just got tough. Yeah, really
what was
tough.
It like going to the Indian Grand Prix as the Indian Grand Prix team?
Bonkers. It was strange. I think the whole of the paddock felt like fish out of water. It was... Everything was there, but it wasn't quite what we were used to. Phenomenal circuit, phenomenal racetrack. Very challenging, but enjoyable. They really know how to celebrate a big event.
In terms of what happened at Jordan, the sort of early 2000s, 1, 2, 3, that's when it started to slip away for Jordan Grand Prix. At what point do you feel Force India started to slip away towards the dark days of administration in 2018?
We struggled for a few years before then. We were really struggling. Formula One had become incredibly expensive.
Sorry to interrupt, but the great irony of that is when you were getting your P4s in the Constructors' Championship.
Yeah, we were. We were operating as a race team very, very well. And we were just going about our thing, though. Just trying to be... innovative. We were trying to think outside the box. Anything that we could try and do to get an edge on anybody else. And I don't know why. It just, in those days, it seemed to be a lot easier to bring upgrades to the car or to modify the car. I mean, the cars now are so, so technical and built so very, very well. The tolerances are tiny now. But in those days, we could look at another car on the grid and get the air saw out and start chopping things around and doing modifications trackside, which we were very good at it. We had some, and we still do, but we had some great engineers trackside that were maybe a little bit old school, and we could just find performance overnight. But the sport's changed very much so now.
So what about 2018? And how different was the change from Force India to Racing Point to the one where we'd gone Jordan Grand Prix to Midland?
Very different. I mean, Lawrence was known to the sport.
Lawrence Stroll.
Yeah, he was known to the sport. His face had been around Formula One since the early 90s. When we got through the summer break, we went into administration before the summer break, and then the news broke that Lawrence was taking charge. It didn't take very long to realise what Lawrence's aspirations were and his ambition and his motivation and just where he wanted to be. He came to see, as soon as the deal was done, he came to see the whole factory, and he made it very, very clear that he wanted to build a team that was capable of winning a world championship. We'd heard those words before many times, but they'd never been delivered with so much conviction. I mean, you were left with no doubt in your mind where Lawrence was going to take the team. And where he's still taking the team.
And 6 years on, Has he delivered on everything he said back then?
And more. Yeah. In a way, we've let him down a little bit. Where we are now, currently, we're working on it, but I feel we should have delivered more for him by now, which we haven't managed to do, but we're working hard on it. But Lawrence, everything that he promised to us, he's delivered and more. I absolutely love working for him. It is a privilege to work for him. It's great to have his guidance, his advice, his encouragement. And the great thing with Lawrence is you know exactly where you stand.
Andy, he's quite an intimidating character outside of the team in the Formula One paddock. What's he like on the inside?
I think he's a great person. He's extremely emotional. You know when he's happy and you know when he's sad. You know, he doesn't hide anything. You get everything from Lawrence, depending, you know, where he is that day. If he asks you to do something and you deliver, he's happy. And if he feels that you've let him down, he'll let you know that as well. But I can see he is an intimidating figure within the paddock. Also, he's a great guy. When he's here in the factory or when he's trackside, I'm quite happy to go and sit and have a conversation with him. And you can have difficult conversations with him. He's certainly not unreasonable, but he will question, and rightly so. He's given us every tool in the box that we need. Everything we ask for, we get. So, of course, the guy can ask, well, where's the results? We have to be able to explain. You know, he doesn't want excuses, but he will listen to explanations. Don't try and tell him a story, because he'll see straight through it.
How long does it take to change the mentality of a race team from the plucky underdog, which it's been for so long, to confident race winner, which is where you want to be?
We've never been a championship-winning race team. So what do you have to do? Where do you have to be? I'm not sure. We're going about our business the best way that we can. And I think we demonstrated in Brazil that we can cope with any challenge you throw at us. And that's not just trackside. That's the whole company. We had a bit of fun in qualifying, obviously, and ended up with both cars coming back with most of their corners and wings missing, which most people in the paddock thought, well, there's going to be two Aston Martins not on the grid. We had a shortened amount of time because of the special schedule we were running and the red flags and the additional time it took to get the cars back to the garage. So I think we had just over 2 hours to do complete rebuilds. And because of what we've set up here at Silverstone, because of the production facilities we have, because of the operations that we have here at Silverstone, because of the way we're organized trackside and the way that we plan meticulously, we're able to build those cars ready for the race start. And that, I think, showed to me that the work we've been doing over the past few years in building up to wanting to challenge for world championships is that we've got an organization that is already meeting the standards required.
And just to be clear on that point, are you saying that the team of 10 years ago wouldn't have been able to rebuild those cars?
If I'm brutally honest, no, we wouldn't. We operate on a completely different level to where we did 10 years ago, partly because of how Formula One's moved on anyway. You've had to improve your game. You've had to up your game. But we've learned a lot of lessons. We've put a lot of processes in place. I mean, I never had a doubt on Sunday that we could get those cars ready because we're that well prepared. Not because being overconfident. I know how much work went into making those components available. We did it so it couldn't fail. We don't want to be doing it week in, week out. It'll be a lot more difficult next time around. But that to me shows, yeah, that we're putting all the pieces in place to challenge for a world championship in the future.
It's clear that you're a man who's all about the future, but I did want to ask you, which era of the 600 races have you enjoyed the most?
I feel that every year's just got better. And you ask, you know, what's the secret to 600 Grand Prix? And it's because every race I go to, I just enjoy it more. The challenges are more, but you have more experience. So you're more comfortable. You're more confident with what you do. So then you enjoy it more and then the next challenge comes along. So I'd have to say the current era. I love looking back at the old races and you, You see the times with the old Jordans going around the circuit and with the era with Ayrton driving around. Magical. But were they the best years I had in Formula One? No. The best years for me are still to come.
You mentioned Ayrton Senna. Did EJ ever tell you that he was trying to get Ayrton Senna to race for Jordan Grand Prix?
Oh, yeah. Of course he did.
Tell you that. And that he offered him, I think, 50% of the team
or
so.
Yeah, of course. And of course, Eddie would try that. It's, yeah, absolutely.
Who is the best driver you've worked with so far?
Oh, the one who got the best results was Heinz, Harald Frentzen. The driver I've probably stayed or kept contact with the longest is Eddie Irvine. The driver who helped us get to Formula One was Bertrand Gachot.
Let me rephrase the question, Andy. Who's the fastest driver you've ever worked with?
There's hundreds. There's hundreds. I think, well, there's Michael. You can't deny it. But there's two drivers that really, really impressed me when I first worked with them. So you get to build relationships with all the drivers, and, you know, I'd like to think I've been friends with all of them, and I wouldn't want to upset any of them by, oh, this guy's better than that guy. But the two drivers that impressed me the most when they first got into the car was Michael. And the second one, it wasn't in Formula One, but was Jean Alesi. Blisteringly quick. Jean went on to have a career where he never met his full potential. But when he arrived in Formula One, he was so fast.
So you weren't surprised by what he was doing in that Tyrrell in...
Absolutely not.
In 89.
Yeah. And we were obviously cheering him on. But it was... you know, there's lots of qualities that make up a modern day Formula One driver now. There's so many things that they have to... So many boxes they have to tick. But they're the guys that really just had this raw speed, just crazy out of the box, fast.
And do you have a favourite moment from these 600 races?
My favourite moment and the reason why Formula One is such a great sport and something I'm really passionate about and proud to be involved in was in Bahrain, and it makes me shake and shiver now, but watching Romain Grosjean climb out of his car after that horrific accident and just walk away. It still gets me emotional now. Fantastic. And that's the culmination of all the hard work, all the development, all the work the FIA have done, and teams searching for performance, but also ensuring that we do it in a controlled and safe way. That moment was everything about Formula One.
Andy, it's been a phenomenal chat. I've really loved it. Now, I keep talking about 600 races, but it's not only 600 races, it's 600 races for the same team. And I did want to end just by asking you, why have you stayed in the same team for so long? Because loyalty isn't something that we see much of in Formula One. People bounce between teams quite regularly, but you haven't.
No. And there's been offers, but none of them have really taken seriously, I guess. I don't know. I think it's personal, and it goes back to that first day with I'll show him. And for me now, I want to see Team Silverstone. I want to be part of Team Silverstone winning world championships. I guess it's like, I don't have a football team, I don't support football, but if Arsenal win the world win the championship one year, the Premiership, and Man City the next, you don't just switch teams. This is my team. I'm extremely proud to be part of it. It's just unfinished business. Say I was to walk away now, and in 2 years' time, Aston Martin doing so well, I'd be absolutely gutted.
Not to be part of it, you mean?
Not to be part of it. And you know, some might say, oh, well, the reason is he's not here anymore, that's why. Maybe I'm a bit frightened of that. I mean, Eddie Jordan always says, you're only still there because no one else will hire you.
he would say that.
Yeah. I just love it here. I absolutely love it. It's been my life for so long, and I just wouldn't even consider working anywhere else. It's just no reason. It's a fantastic place to work.
That's a brilliant place to end it. Andy, thank you very much. Can we just end with our quick fire questions? Which racing person, dead or alive, would you want to be stuck in a lift with?
Fangio.
Why him?
Well, he was the greatest of all time.
What would you want to talk to him about?
Just to understand how in that era he could be as fast and as brave. Just lots of things I'd like to learn about that era. We jump on a plane now and we fly off to America and Brazil to do a race. It's quite straightforward. These guys, it was an adventure just to get to the track, then risk their life, and then risk their life going home. So it was an incredible era of the sport that I don't know much about and clearly wasn't involved back then. So he's a legend of the sport. There are many legends, but you know he's got to be the ultimate.
Who would play you in a film?
No one famous.
How about George Clooney? There you go.
Yeah, I'll take that.
Who is the coolest person in your contacts?
Joanna Shields, my wife.
Do you get to meet a lot of celebs?
Lots of celebrities, yeah. Not really anything I get that excited about. It's not necessarily meeting the celebrity. It's great meeting the person. And the opportunity that we get within the paddock and being involved in Formula One, I mean, we're all very normal people doing an exciting job. But celebrities arrive and they seem to open up to you. It's almost like they feel like they're in a safe space. You get them in the paddock, you've got famous racing drivers that we see every day, but they're in an environment where they feel they're relaxed and can open up. So met some great celebrities, but only because they're great people, not because they're really famous people.
Andy, it's been brilliant to chat. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
I loved talking to Andy. So many stories, and through them, I feel I understand Team Silverstone better now. The tenacity of the team is epitomised by Andy, who's a racer through and through. It's hard to pick a favourite anecdote, but Schumacher finishing his own seat back in 1991 was gold, as was everything related to Heinz Harald Frentzen. Andy, thank you for your time. It was great to chat, and here's to the next 600 races. As ever, I'd love to get your thoughts on what you've just heard. Please get in touch through all the usual means. I'm at Tom Clarkson F1, or you can use the hashtag F1 Beyond the Grid, which segues beautifully into what you sent in about my conversation with Alpine team principal Ollie Oakes last week. We had lots of positive feedback about Ollie, such as this from Karen. He seems like the man for the job, focused and humble, and also a world karting champion, which is an accolade that eludes a lot of great drivers. Yes, Karen, Ollie is both a great driver and a great guy, and I think he's already bringing an element of stability to Alpine. Well, that's almost it for this week. A couple of parish notices before I go. F1 Nation's review of the Las Vegas Grand Prix is out now. I'm joined by Lawrence Barreto, Christian Horner and Giampiero Lambiassi to reflect on Max Verstappen becoming a four-time world champion. And of course, George Russell's flawless weekend to lead a Mercedes 1-2. And the latest episode of F1 Explains is all about how Formula One took over Las Vegas to make the race happen. Both of those shows are on your podcast app now. I will, of course, be back next week with another great guest from the world of Formula One. But for now, thanks for listening. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.
Okay. Only 10 more presents to wrap. You're almost at the finish line. But first, there, the last one. Enjoy a Coca-Cola for a pause that refreshes.